Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear arguments from petitioners in First Bank versus Tony's Tortilla Factory.
May it please the court, Ms. Kathleen Wallsburn will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Mr. Phillips. Your Honor, the appellate's decision in this case is the first case in the nation to hold that an NSF fee can be interest for purposes of usury recovery. We are here today to correct that ruling. This case has attracted national attention, and it has generated significant interest by amici, both here and in the Court of Appeals on motion for rehearing. The impact of this case is already being felt in Texas court. Just yesterday, I received a copy of an order issued in a bankruptcy case in the Western District of Texas in which involving the same allegations and in which the court stayed all of the proceedings pending this court's resolution of this controversy. For that reason, we are extremely grateful for the court having accepted the case for review and, in addition, for advancing the case so early on the submission docket. We would remind the court, in addition to our application for writ of error, we have also filed a pre-submission brief rebutting the contentions that there are other issues before the court today than the narrow two questions that have been presented for review. As to the corporation, there is only one issue. That issue is whether the trial court was correct to direct a verdict on the usury claim in favor of First Bank and trustee. As to the interveners, was the Court of Appeals correct in disposing of that claim? Now, our major issue, major focus today will of course be on the usury claim, but we would submit that proper resolution of the case involves a resolution of the disposition by the Court of Appeals, both as to reversing and as to sua sponte severance of those claims, but for that we will rely on our brief in the interest of time. This brings us to the usury question. You have before you something that you have seen before, both by way of exhibit and as a handout this morning, a chart illustrating the basic flaw in the corporation's case. We never had interest. Therefore, we never had usury. We begin with the statute. Interest in Texas is defined by statute. Is defined as compensation allowed by law for the use, forbearance, or detention of money. In the case before you yesterday, which was also a use case, it was undisputed that there was compensation for the use of money. In the case today, it is undisputed that it was not. When interest becomes greater than what is allowed by law, it becomes usury. But you cannot have usury if you don't have interest. This court's decision in construing the statutory definition of interest has consistently required that to be interest, a charge must be compensation to the lender for the use, forbearance, or detention of money. In this case, everyone's evidence, First Bank's evidence and the corporation's evidence, establishes that First Bank assessed the same fee, whether or not it chose to honor a check. Your Honors, a fee cannot be compensation for the use of money if the same fee is assessed when the bank honors the check by advancing money or returns the check by refusing to advance money. A fee that's charged whether or not money is advanced cannot have any connection to the advancement of money. in the only reported case to have ever considered whether insufficient fund fees can be interest. The California Supreme Court summarily rejected the contention. In this case, we have, of course, cited to you before. It did so using that premise, the very same reasoning, whether or not money is advanced. This case, reading from the language of the court, the bank, this is in the Purdue case, California Supreme Court, the bank charges the same fee whether it honors or rejects an insufficient funds check. The fee, consequently, cannot be intended as compensation for the credit risk arising from the paying such a check or for the interest on the amount loaned. In determining also under federal law, and this has been very well presented to you, very well developed in the Texas Bankers Amicus Brief as well as in our application, in determining whether a finance charge is excessive under truth in lending law, a charge can't be a finance charge if the same, whether or not credit is extended. The record will reflect, Your Honor, that that is precisely the reasoning that precipitated the directed verdict in this case. The fee was assessed whether or not the bank honored the check. That's at Statement of Facts 1315 to 1316. Immediately following that, the trial court rendered directed verdict on the usury claim. Passing from the issue of whether or not, we go to the second issue, which is concerned the top half of the chart, and this is, if a fee is assessed whether or not money is advanced, what is it assessed for? It must be for something else. What is that something else? Since the turn of the century, even going back before Goldring, which we decided, and the cases that we've cited in Goldring, this court has recognized that when a fee entitles the customer to distinctly separate and additional consideration, other than the lending of money, it is not interest. Now, in Goldring, we had attorney's fees. This court held that it was undisputed that the attorney's fees were related to securing the collateral and therefore had no relationship to the advance of money. That's what the top of that half chart says. The evidence in this case, just like Goldring, shows that the bank advanced distinctly separate and additional consideration for that NSF fee. And what was it? It was the processing. Extensive evidence during a week's trial showed the multi-step process for processing an insufficient funds check at First Bank. This evidence, Your Honors, is uncontroverted. The corporation never disputed. There is no evidence that disputes that the fee was for this purpose, a separate and additional consideration of processing. First Bank, based on these two showings, was entitled to the direct verdict on the usury claim, because the corporation never met its burden of proof. It never met its burden of proof to show at the threshold that we had interest so that we could get to usury. The corporation failed to present any evidence to raise a fact issue on this for two reasons. The bottom half of the chart, the evidence conclusively establishes that the fee was assessed whether or not the bank decided in discretion under the UCC to honor that check. The evidence also establishes that the NSF fee was for distinctly separate and additional consideration other than lending of money. Now, the Court of Appeals was wrong on both of those accounts, but it was equally wrong for a third reason, because as our chart illustrates to you, there is no connection between the whether or not and the distinctly separate and additional consideration. The Court of Appeals compounded the error in failing to see this by saying that what we really had here was the insufficient funds fee serving as the basis for overdraft protection. Your Honor, there is no evidence that this is what was going on. In addition to alleging usury against First Bank and the trustee, the corporation also alleged unconscionability, deceptive misrepresentations, undue influence, civil conspiracy, wrongful foreclosure, negligence, and gross negligence. Now, why are we getting into that? These allegations called into question the entire banking relationship between the customer, the corporation, and First Bank. We are getting into that because there have been questions raised in response to our application for writ of error that challenge the reasonableness of the fees, which this court has said is not relevant to the question of usury. And in addition, this is something that's already been decided by the jury. We are also asked to consider duration, and we're asked to consider the profit motive. These issues, Your Honors, were all resolved by favorable jury findings in favor of First Bank. These findings were not challenged, were not brought forward on appeal, and there was no point of error in a motion for rehearing or any motion for rehearing challenging any determination that by which they're trying to inject new issues into the sole issue before us. In closing this major portion of our presentation, we would challenge the corporation in its presentation to convince this court that they did present a fact issue on whether or not we had interest. And I would ask the corporation to do this without delving into matters that have already been resolved in favor of the bank. With that, unless the court has questions, I will.
Spring, I have a question.
Justice Gonzalez.
Assuming that the court agrees with you on the first issue, on this issue that this is not interest and therefore it cannot be usury, assuming that the court agrees with that position, what then about the intervention? Do we have to even get into the intervention?
We feel that the Court of Appeals was wrong to sever these claims sua sponte, and simply because, as we've mentioned in our brief, the disposition of the case shows that the court completely has substituted its discretion for that of the trial court. Indeed, in supporting the sua sponte severance, the interveners basically concede this is one of the things that you can do. This is one of the things that the trial judge did not do.
But if the court were to agree with you that this is not usury, anything that we do with interveners would be moot. The interveners would not have a cause of action.
We agree with that premise.
So why even deal with the second issue about the intervention?
We feel it's before the court by virtue of the Court of Appeals disposition. But we basically agree with you on the position that there is nothing left.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Jimmy Phillips, Jr. will present argument.
May it please the court, I did not know that the intervention was going to be argued today, but I would like to address, before I address the primary argument, the question that was just asked. In my opinion, the intervention is viable, and is viable regardless of what this court would do, because the issues raised by the intervener were never determined by a court or a jury. And therefore, they have a right to that determination.
Well, the trial court severed those out, correct?
Pardon?
The posture of the case, if you look at what the trial court did, the trial court severed and did not allow the intervention.
That is correct.
Therefore, the interveners, but for the Court of Appeals' opinion, had every right to file their own lawsuit if they wanted to.
Well, that is correct, except if the court did not allow them, then the court would have severed them out should have severed them out into a separate lawsuit and not simply dismissed the intervention. The court dismissed the intervention, which would have been interlocutory.
You say that was an abuse of discretion?
Yes. But since I don't represent the interveners, I'm not here to argue their intervention. I'd like to address the primary argument which I have. I apologize to the court. But I just got my voice back this morning, not being able to speak all day yesterday. Most of what I've got to say is in the brief that's outlined in the brief, and I don't want to rehash what I said in that brief. I do want to address one thing, and that's this diagram that we have up there. And that's the assertion that it is undisputed that this is a, quote, service charge for the processing of checks. It would be undisputed that it was a service charge for the processing of checks if the check was not paid when it was processed. Because the check was paid and a loan was made and over $1 million advanced, it is disputed as to whether the $20 charge that appeared on the balance sheet and the end of month statement that my client received was in essence simply a charge for processing expenses, or it was money for the continued lending and advancement of funds on an insufficient account. And that is the fallacy in this chart that is before the court.
Your statement is that what's wrong with the chart, that the Tony Tortilla Factory had a separate arrangement with the bank to cover hot checks in exchange for the payment of this processing fee? You're saying that?
It's by inference that is correct.
Well, if you're going to raise the inference, then don't you have to show that they did not charge this same fee when they didn't? I mean, the argument from the bank is we charge the fee whether we pay it or not. You're arguing, well, for Tony's Factory, they paid the check, so therefore this must be interest. But that's not their point is the bank charged it to people who they didn't pay the check on, as well as charging it to Tony's Tortilla Factory. Therefore, it's not interest because Tony didn't get that charge because they got the loan.
Well,
I mean, you understand my question is, does the evidence challenge that whether or not they charged if they did not advance the money?
I'll try to reply. That is true, except who places the label? The bank has placed the label. The label is in dispute. The dispute is intent. Intent is a factual situation. Goldring, relied upon by the petitioners, was not a factual situation. It was a situation in which both parties had stipulated the facts and said, based on these facts, what is the law? Goldring, referred to by them, is not the same sort of case because the fee had no connection with the loan other than it was a requirement that that fee be included in the new loan package.
Were any checks not
Pardon?
Were any of Tony's Tortilla Factory checks not paid?
I don't believe so. I think they were all paid.
In this period?
In this period of time. And this $20 fee was charged. There were a few times when the fee was not charged.
But
except
Phillips,
for the last.
Let me back up.
Yeah.
Do you accept the proposition, which is in the statute, that interest is a charge for the use, forbearance, or detention of money?
That is correct.
And you agree with the proposition that you cannot have usury unless you have interest?
That is correct.
All right. And you also agree with the proposition that interest is the principal times a rate times a time.
The calculation of interest and the amount of interest charged or percentage-wise would be part of that formula, but the formula doesn't
What other formula is there for computing interest other than the principal times a rate times a time? Do you know of any other formula?
Yes, you know.
What is it?
In the record itself, the bank president says that if they make a small loan, under $1,000, they charge a flat rate for making the loan.
They don't compute it based on principal times a rate for the time? rate and timing are relevant?
No, sir, they can charge a flat rate. I believe the flat rate's $15 for the month.
In other words, you're saying they charge a fee?
Yes.
If it's a flat rate, it's a fee rather than...
Interest.
Calculated interest?
Rather than calculated interest. And in several cases, in the one in Beaumont where they had talked about a loan fee of $25, it was held that that was a factual dispute as to whether or not that was interest. And that was just a one-time fee.
It's charged for the use of the money.
Pardon?
It's charged for the use of the money.
It was charged for the use of money.
Ms. Phillips, Ms. Burney made a statement that there is no case in the United States other than this Court of Appeals case that has held that checks of NSF are considered interest or usury.
There's no case that has raised the issue of continuation to the tune of $1 million and more than 2,500 checks on which this occurred. The evidence in this case, if you read the record and the testimony, and that's what's wrong with the chart, is profit.
That's what?
Profit. The bank contends that this is...
Well, you would expect them to do any business for not-for-profit.
No, I do not. But
so what is the point?
The point is, Your Honor, that they are allowed to charge this processing fee in the very first part by statute, which allows them to reimburse themselves for expenses incurred in processing the check. Their testimony was this is a profitable fee. Their testimony was we do not discourage our clients or our customers from writing hot checks, because it is profitable to us for them to write the hot checks, us to advance the funds, and us to collect the profit.
But get back to definitions. How is that usurious if usury is a charge above the legal rate? And that's the only way you can get usury.
Yes, sir.
So how would you write an opinion if you were to write an opinion upholding the position that you advocate in terms of defining interest and usury?
Interest is the use for forbearance of money. You find the rate of interest by taking the amount of money charged and the amount of time of the loan.
And you plug that definition to the facts of this case?
The facts in this case, and it was introduced into evidence as a daily basis, the checks were paid within a day, usually up until the very end. So the check and the fee were paid within a day. You take the amount of the check, $100. You take the amount of the fee, $20. You calculate that on the basis of 360 days, and you come up with a rate which is far in excess of 6% per annum. 6% per annum was the legal rate that they could charge because they had no contract as to how much interest they could charge.
Are you picking the time out of the air?
No, sir. I'm talking about what was presented in evidence as Exhibit 1, as a...
If they charge a flat fee, if whether the hot check was there for one day or 20 days, it's a flat fee, and you're trying to convert that into...
Not for the hot check, Judge. For the loaning of the funds when they paid the check. You see, what's happened is the bank has hit on a scheme where they can take a legitimate charge for not paying the check and turn it into a way to make more than the amount of interest allowed by law by advancing funds. It is the continued advancing funds, the continued encouragement of the customer to write these kind of checks rather than going down and making a loan.
You know, the Federal Truth in Lending has a lot of requirements with regards to loans and disclosures. What was the, there were no notes, no agreements signed. There was nothing in writing between the bank and Tony Sotia Factory as to what was the principal, what was the rate, or what was the time. to be borrowed. Is that correct?
That is correct.
If, how does the law treat money paid as a penalty for the late payment or late repayment of a loan? For instance, a bank negotiates a loan, charges a legal rate of interest, but writes into that a proviso if the interest, if the installment payment, say, is not paid on a designated schedule, that they will impose a penalty, flat rate penalty for late payment. How does the law regard that additional, that penalty in addition to interest for the repayment of a loan?
It is my belief that the law regards that it's statute. At one time it was tacked on as interest, but there is a statute, the banking statutes allow a reasonable fee to be charged.
They do not regard it as interest.
Pardon?
They do not regard it as interest.
The statute itself does not regard it as interest. The excess of a reasonable fee would be regarded as interest.
How is that situation different from the situation here? If you have an account that is overdrawn and they advance the money to cover withdrawals on that account in the form of checks, and they impose a flat rate, assume that the account itself is in the nature of the principal of a loan, and your deposits are repayments, and you're late with the deposit, since you're late with the repayment. How is that different if the fee for the late payment is reasonable, even though
first
the statute doesn't extend its coverage to that?
First of all, you know what the late payment is because of the contract. Secondly, if the late payment was unreasonable, for instance, you had a payment of $20 that was due each month and they charge a $5 fee if it's late, that might be reasonable. If they charged a $5,000 fee if it was late and it was clearly unreasonable, then what would it be? It would be interest on the loan because it's part of paying the loan. And that's what's happening here. They're not just charging a fee and processing a check and sending it back to another bank. They are paying the check, loaning the money, and then charging the fee. It becomes a factual issue, not a matter of law, but a factual issue.
The amount of the check that's covered determines whether it's a reasonable charge. In other words, if it's a $5 check and they charge a $20 fee, that's 400% of the amount of the check involved, or the amount of the money advanced.
That is correct. If it were one check that they did it on, if it was two checks they did it on, that's argument. But where it is $1,200,000 in funds advanced and they say we got nothing back, it is an unreasonable argument. A bank is not in the business for goodwill to advance $1,200,000 in funds and not get some profitability back.
Is it your position that the NSF charge is always interest whenever the check is not sounded?
No. It is a factual issue. It goes to the weight.
And what is the evidence in this case that would indicate that it's interest here and not merely a charge?
That it was profitable, that the bank encouraged its customers who would repay the checks to do their business that way.
But it was profitable even if the check was dishonored.
That's true. But there was no advancement or loan, and you would have another theory of law, which is they are charging a fee which is unreasonable based upon the expenses they have.
But your view is that's true whether they honor or dishonor the check. That's true of all circumstances. How does that indicate that it's interest here?
Because one or two things would happen if they had not paid the check. There would be no continual paying of the fee by the customer because he would quit very quickly writing those checks.
They're still making the charge. The bank is still making the charge.
They make the charge but it is the label they place on the charge. We don't know that they didn't intend that to be interest.
If the charge is always made, whether the check is honored or dishonored, and it's always profitable, or in the scheme of things it is, what evidence is there then that, in this particular case, this was interest and not a charge?
The evidence is the evidence of the expert in the banking business who testified that the manner in which this scheme was laid out indicates that the money was paid for the use of funding the money and not simply as a charge processing a check.
Do you agree that even if the check is dishonored, there still may be processing charges for which the bank can charge a fee?
If the check is dishonored and not paid?
Yes.
I agree that there may be processing checks.
And you would have a sliding scale, sliding fee, depending on the amount of the check?
No, sir. I again go back to the question of fact as to the intent of the bank and whether or not this fee was going to allow the continued advancement of funds. It is the continuation and not the sporadic charging.
Is there any line you could draw for a summary judgment when the bank honors an insufficient funds check? Or would you say that if a bank honors such a check and makes a charge for it, they've always bought themselves a lawsuit, a jury trial?
If the bank honors the check and they make a charge for it, then they may have bought themselves a lawsuit. As a practical matter, on one or two checks, there's not going to be a lawsuit.
Well, Mr. Phillips, perhaps I misunderstood you, but in response to Justice Gamish's question, I heard you say that if the check was small, the fee should be small. And if the check was large, it was dishonored, you can charge more fee. And you would have a sliding scale depending on the size of the check.
My point was that if the check is small and the fee is large, there comes into play an easier decision on the unreasonableness of the fee. We keep coming back to the fact that the bank should not be allowed to take a method authorized by law for compensation of expenses and turn that into a scheme to loan $1,200,000 at usurious interest rates. It's a question of fact to be determined by a jury, and that's all we ask.
Back to the question I asked a while ago, maybe just a moment. There's a special statute or there's statutory provision that the penalty charged for a late repayment is exactly that. By law, it is a penalty. Don't know whether it has the term reasonable in it or not. Prior to the enactment of that statute, what was the status of the common law? I think I recall hearing you say that up until the time the statute was enacted, the penalty was treated as additional interest.
That is my understanding, and that was the reason for the statute to lay at rest what it would be.
Was that the common law, or was that earlier statute?
I believe it was the common law. I don't think there was any statute which regulated
that. Charge a reasonable legal rate of interest, you can impose a reasonable penalty or a penalty beyond that, but that was also considered part of the interest.
I don't think that at common law you could impose a penalty. At common law, everything that you charged on that loan is okay.
The statute says you can impose a penalty, and it's not to be considered part of the interest or late repayment. That's here you have a statutory provision permitting banks to charge a reasonable penalty for insufficient funds, do you not?
You do, but the bank cannot take the statute and use it as a scheme to get around the rates which are set. And that's what they're doing in this instance.
You're saying that if that penalty is significantly higher than their cost of actually processing that check, it's probably an unreasonable penalty under the statute if they advance funds on an insufficient check, and it should be construed as interest because they are doing it, charging it for the use of the money.
Well, you see, you're assuming that we do not dispute the fact that they say this is insufficient funds charge. It's the same amount as insufficient funds charge, but it is our contention that they made that charge for the advancing of the checks,
you're saying,
not for the processing of the check.
You're saying regardless of the nomenclature, because the cost of processing the check is minuscule related to, in relationship to the money that they harvest, to the profits that they harvest from this operation, and that if they advance funds, it should be construed as interest.
Well, it could be construed as interest. It is a question of fact, a question of intent to be determined by the fact finder.
How would you charge the jury? What would be the instructions and what would be the issues as you perceive them?
As I receive it, the instruction to the jury would be whether or not the charge
on each individual check or global?
Pardon?
On each individual check that was honored or not dishonored? Would the jury have to make a particular separate determination on each check and on each
since all the checks were handled in the same manner? They would, you could probably submit a general instruction to the jury as to the intent.
How would you define interest?
I would define interest the way you defined interest.
And how would you define usury?
I would define it usury as the amount of interest allowed by law, which in this case, undisputedly, would be 6% per annum.
And what would you use for a time factor?
The time factor would be the amount of time it took for each check to be paid, and there is sufficient facts in the record to calculate that.
So if there were 1,000 checks, the jury would have to make a determination on each 1,000, on each check?
They would have to make a general determination as the amount of the jury's interest that was charged. You could do it by summary. You could do it by... they just have to do it from the information. You could ask it either way, separate checks, or you could ask one general question as to how much interest was charged. But there were two. First of all, they would have to go through the first part before they get to the second part. The first part being the intent of the charge. Was it intended to be forbearance? Was it intended simply to be a hot check charge, and the bank expected no money for advancing $1,200,000. If they find that the bank expected compensation for it, and this was the compensation the bank expected for advancing the money, then they would address the factual issue as to how much usurious interest was charged and which of it was in excess of three times the amount of allowed by law, or 18%. Perfect.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tom.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, I have heard only argument. I have not heard evidence. The issues of reasonableness have been dredged up again before you and the issues of the bank's profit motive. Reasonableness was addressed by adoption in Stedman versus Georgetown Savings and Loan. This was cited in Goldring.
Let me ask you a hypothetical.
Yes.
Suppose a depositor informs the bank that there may be a series of NSF checks which he wishes to have covered by an advance of funds time after time after time and charged against the line of credit. The bank agrees to do that, but does charge an NSF charge every time such a check comes through. Why wouldn't that be a charge for the extension of credit, just like a point on a loan or some other kind of charge would be?
We have no quarrel with that, Your Honor. That would depend on what was in the contemplation of the parties. And the evidence shows in this case that they really did have that arrangement that you set up, that it was not ever meant. It was supposed to be there as a line of credit. It quickly became overdrawn, very, very quickly. But there, in fact, there was a question during
during the evidence in the case that asked, well, couldn't you use that money? That was there. And it made very, very clear that the bank can't make those business decisions for the customer because the customer is in control of that. The customer would also be in control of the negotiations.
Well, if the NSF charge could, under the hypothetical that I've given you, constitute interest, then why isn't the respondent right that it's a factual question in each case?
The respondent is not right because the evidence in this case does not present that fact issue. There is a presumption of legality in arrangements between the bank and its customer. There is no evidence, and in fact, Mr. Phillips has conceded this morning that the bank charged the same fee whether or not the bank honored the check or returned it. And in response to Justice Spector's question, he conceded that there's evidence that checks were returned. As we've explained earlier, there can't be interest if the same fee is assessed when there's no credit advance. That's what our record shows.
But he's saying in those cases where credit is advanced by covering the check, extending money for use to cover those checks, that it amounts to interest. So I understand is regardless of the bank's policy and the bank's nomenclature under the facts of a particular insufficient funds check, if they advance the funds, he's arguing that is interest.
I agree that's what he's arguing, but that's all he can get. He's only arguing. He can't make out of the evidence in this case what he's saying happened. He can't do it because in the top half of this check, it has been of this chart, it's been the law of this state since the turn of the century that when you have undisputed evidence that a fee is separate and apart, distinctly separate and additional consideration, independent of the advancement of money, it is not interest. That's Texas law.
Ms. Barron, could the bank charge $100 for an NSF fee?
Now, that's an interesting question. I suppose that it could if that were in the contemplation of the parties.
In excess, in other words, in excess of the cost, the approximate cost of processing NSF checks in lieu of any interest for advancing funds.
It could, but that's not raised here.
I understand your argument that that's not supported by the evidence here, but you concede that there could be an arrangement, there could be a case under which Mr. Phillips' argument would work, that is, that NSF charges in excess of the cost of processing checks could be charged in lieu of a charge of interest for advancing funds.
I really think that what you're talking about is an overdraft protection arrangement, and that would be subject to whatever would control that agreement.
Well, I'm talking about not a formal arrangement.
Conceivably, in a given set of facts, you can have what Mr. Phillips would like to see here, but it's simply not in our record.
Statute, what is the exact language of the statute that provides for this fee? Is that the bank may charge a reasonable fee?
Your Honor, I have no knowledge of that statute. I'd be happy to help you with that and by post-submission.
Well, my point is, if indeed the statute talks in terms of reasonable, we need some definition of reasonable. Is it if it's a reason, sir, I think anyone would agree that it is reasonable for the bank to recoup its cost for processing an insufficient funds check. How much above and beyond that is reasonable if it costs, say, $3.50 to process an insufficient funds check? Is a $20 fee reasonable, whether the check is for $5, 400% of the amount of the check, or whether the check is for $500,000? If the cost of processing is $3.50, is that reasonable? Is that within the meaning of the statute?
I would be incompetent to give you an opinion about that, Justice Gingrich, but I will answer you that, as we said in our pre-submission memorandum, the bank, the corporation, elected to present their challenge to the reasonableness of the fee as a claim for unconscionability. That was in the pleadings. Our jury, in response to that question, said there is no gross disparity between the value advanced and the value received. And that is in the attachment from the jury charge that is attached to the pre-submission brief. That's why we did it.
Let me return again to the prior line of questioning, which the conclusion was, as I understood your statement, that there could be facts in which case the respondent would win. What are those facts?
If the respondent were able to show, distinct from this case, that we do not have a situation where the fee was imposed whether or not the bank charged the account, whether the bank paid the check or dishonored the check. And also we would not, the respondent would win if the bank did not show distinctly separate and additional consideration. Because in this case, we have prevailed on those and met our burden. And because the respondent failed to present any evidence on this cloak or subterfuge or overdraft theory that he advanced, we never got to the jury.
So let me come again to my hypothetical. Assume that the bank charges the same NSF charge no matter what, honored or dishonored in every circumstance, and it is the same fee. And a depositor comes in and says, I'm about to write some NSF checks, and I want those to be charged against my line of credit as they come in. And the bank says, fine, but we're going to charge an NSF charge every time one comes through. Can that be interest?
Arguably, yes. Yes.
And under what facts? Additional facts. Because isn't that your case here, in essence, except they didn't just come face-to-face and talk it out. But that's exactly what happened here, isn't it?
I don't think it is what happened here, Judge.
What's the difference?
The difference is here we have an understanding. I keep getting back to this. We don't have interest. If you don't have interest, you don't have usury. We would remind the court, I see that the red light is long, but we would like to, with the court's indulgence, the usury statute is punitive in nature. It must be strictly construed. The more serious the penalty, the more serious the construction of the definition of usury and the definition of interest. This case has a very, very broad impact. We're seeing it. But unless this case is reversed under these facts, this case will change the way banks do business with their customers. They will not honor those checks. This will ultimately affect the small businesses just like Tony's Tortilla Factory, Inc., which their own expert conceded today. We are working with people in arrangements like this more and more. And he worked for Nation NCNB.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument of this call. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will plead the judgment court.